In general, only something which is edible for humans to eat can gain truma status, and therefore animal food cannot become truma. However, there's an exception, and that is karshine truma. This refers to a certain vegetable known as vetch, which is truma, and the reason why this can become truma, even though it's animal food, is because when someone was short of food, for example in a famine, so then people would eat karshinim. So it is edible, and in times of need, it is considered human food. And the question is, it can become truma, so once a kohen receives it, what can he do with that truma? In general, one is not allowed to feed his animals truma. But in this case, the kohen is allowed to feed the karshinim to domestic animals, to wild animals, to chicken. The reason being that that is considered the regular use of this food. So although the only reason why it's obligated in truma is because it's considered human food, the general use of that food is for animals, and therefore you are allowed to feed it to animals. Continues the Mishnah, Yisrael shesochar parah mekohen, a Yisrael who rents a cow from a kohen. So since he is only renting it, the kohen is still considered to be the owner, and the only owner. And therefore, ma'achilo karshinei teruma, the Yisrael, while he is renting the cow, is allowed to feed the cow karshinei teruma, because a kohen's animals are allowed to consume k'truma, and this is still considered to be the kohen's animal. On the other hand, v'chohen shesachar parah Yisrael, if a kohen rents a cow from a Yisrael, so the owner is still considered to be the Yisrael. So whatever the Yisrael is allowed to eat, his animals are allowed to eat. So since the Yisrael cannot eat truma, afal bishamin zayin seha alav, even though the kohen is responsible for feeding the animal, nevertheless, he is not considered the owner, and therefore, the kohen may not feed the animal karshinei teruma. Now that's with regards to regular renting. However, we're now going to see another form of renting where the halacha will be the exact opposite. Yisrael sheshom parah mekohen. Yisrael who was shom an animal, a cow, from a kohen. Shom comes from the word shuma, which means to evaluate. And under this deal, the Yisrael takes the kohen's cow, and they evaluate how much the cow is worth, and the Yisrael will raise the cow, often from when it's very young. And once the deal is over, so let's say the deal was that the Yisrael would raise the kohen's cow for a year, the agreement made is that the Yisrael needs to pay the original worth, the original value of the cow, and as well as that, the added value to the cow is shared between the Yisrael and the kohen. So since the Yisrael is paying the kohen the exact original value, we don't consider this to be a rental, rather more like a sale. So the Yisrael is considered to be the owner of the animal, and therefore lo ya'achilena karshinei teruma, he cannot feed the animal karshinim of teruma, because the animal is owned by a Yisrael. However, v'chohen shesham parah Yisrael, if a kohen did this deal with a Yisrael, so the kohen is going to raise the cow, now the kohen is considered to be the owner, and therefore ma'achila karshinei teruma, he would be allowed to feed the animal teruma, which is of karshinim, since he is not only responsible for feeding the animal, but he totally owns the animal for at least this time period. Mishnah Yud, as we have seen a number of times throughout the Masechta, if truma becomes tomei, then a kohen is not allowed to eat it, rather he has to burn the truma. But he is allowed to benefit from burning that. So for example, if he's burning oil, then he can use that for light. Namidrabonon, just like it's forbidden for a non-kohen, for a czar, to eat truma, it's also forbidden for him to benefit from the burning of truma. So if there's no kohen around, then certainly it will be forbidden for Yisrael to light a wick which is in truma oil in order to benefit from the light, even if he has the permission of the kohen, because a Yisrael, a czar, is not allowed to benefit from the burning of truma. However, the Rabbanon did make a few exceptions, and for example, Madlikin Shemen Sereifa, it is permitted to light Shemen Sereifa, which literally means burnt oil, but Shemen Sereifa always refers to oil which is truma, which became tome and therefore needs to be burnt. So the truma oil can be burnt bevote kinesias, in shuls bevote medrashos, and in bote medrash, where people learn Torah and verse ha'afilin, and in dark public alleyways, because in these three cases it's a public need. And in case of a public need, even if there are no kohanim there, the Rabbanon did not decree that Zorim cannot benefit from truma, and therefore in a case of a public need, this would be permitted. Now there's another leniency, and that is val gabe acholin, above ill people, if people are visiting the ill person, and there's no light there, then they are also able to benefit from the light of a wick which is in truma oil. However, in that case, it has to be Birshus Kohen, with the permission of a Kohen, and the truth is, many understand this to mean that a Kohen has to be there as well. And then if a kohen lights the candle for himself, so other people can also benefit, because he is not increasing the amount of light because of the other people, because he himself needs the same amount of light. So since the kohen is lighting it totally for himself, Zorim are also allowed to benefit from that in that situation. But in a regular case where it's not for an ill person, it's not for a mitzvah or a public need, then even if a kohen is doing it for himself, a Zor would not be able to benefit. So we see that in a case of a public need, then even if a kohen is not there, it's permitted. And in a case of a mitzvah, such as visiting an ill person, it is permitted as long as there's a kohen there. Based on this, we're going to have a four-way machlekes to do with a couple of other places where oil was burnt for light. And those places are firstly a Beis Hamishteh, which is a house of feasting, and it refers to a wedding, a wedding celebration, and the other one is a Beis HaOvel, a house of mourning. So both these places are facilitating a mitzvah, either to comfort mourners or to bring joy to the chosn and kala, to the bride and groom who just got married. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, Madlikim Beis HaMishteh, it is permitted to light Shemen Serefa in a wedding hall, Avalei Beis HaOvel, but not in a mourning house. The Rabbi Yehuda, that is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, and the reason for Rabbi Yehuda is that they are both places of a mitzvah, so it should be allowed, because there are kohanim in both places. However, in a house of mourning, we're concerned that a non-kohen, a zar, might move one of the lamps to a corner where only he is benefiting from it, and therefore it's forbidden there, whereas in a wedding, people are wearing very nice clothes, they're dressed up, so they won't come to move the lamps, because then they'll get oil on their hands and risk dirtying their clothes. So that's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. However, Rabbi Yossi says the exact opposite. But Beis HaOvel, it is permitted in a house of mourning, Avalei Beis HaMishteh, but not in a wedding hall. And the reason for this is that in a house of mourning, people are very sad and serious, so they're unlikely to start moving everything around. However, at a wedding, people are very happy and joyous, they're less serious, so they are more likely to start moving around the lamps, so they might come to move it to a place where there are no kohanim, and therefore it is forbidden to burn Shemen Serefa for the sake of light in a wedding. Third opinion, Rabbi Meir also kan lachan. Rabbi Meir forbids both these cases, and he combines both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi's opinions. He says that you can't do it at a wedding hall, because since people are happier, they might come to move the oil. And you can't do it in a house of mourning, because people haven't got such nice clothes, so they're not concerned about getting oil on their hands. And finally, Rabbi Shimon Matar kan lachan. Rabbi Shimon permits both cases, again using both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi's logic, that at a wedding, people have very nice clothes, so they don't want to dirty their clothes, so they won't move the lamp. And in a mourning place, people are very serious, so they won't move the lamps. So you see we've got four different opinions, which cover all of the options here, as to whether one is allowed to move a lamp in a wedding hall or a house of mourning, and whether we're concerned that it will be moved to a place where only a Yisrael is there and not any Kohanim. Solik Maseches Trimus, the longest Masechta in Seder Zeraim, Mazel Tov. Maseches Maisers contains five Prakim only, and it's the first of a few shorter Masechtas in Seder Zeraim. Now the term Maisras is usually used as a collective term for all the different tithes. So Truma, which is the gift which goes to Kohanim, Maisar Rishon, which is a tenth of one's produce which goes to a Levi, Maisar Sheni, which is a tenth of one's produce which he eats himself, but he has to eat it in Yerushalayim, and Maisar Sheni only applies in the first, second, fourth, and fifth years of the Shemitah cycle. There's a seven-year cycle, at the end of which is the year of Shemitah, where it's forbidden to work with the land, and in the first, second, fourth, and fifth years of the Shemitah cycle, one is obligated to separate Maisar Sheni for himself. Now, in the other 2 years, in the third and the sixth year, there's a different obligation, and that is Maisar Oni, which is a tenth of one's produce, which goes to poor people. So these are the main tithes, and also when the Levi receives Maisar Rishon, which is a tenth of the farmer's produce, he has to separate a tenth of that and give it to a kohen as Trumas Maisa. So the term Maisras refers to all these different tithes, and the Masechta begins with two fundamental rules with regards to Maisras. Klal Omer B'Maisras, the Chachom said a rule with regards to Maisras. And before we see the rule, it's important to know that although this is subject to debate, most Mishforshim hold that only grapes, olives, and grain are obligated according to the Torah in Maisras. All other food which is obligated is only obligated in Midrabanan. This is the majority opinion amongst the Mefarshim. And so the rule which we're going to give now, according to that opinion, is Midrabanan. And although we're going to explain that it's learnt from a posuk, so how can it be Midrabanan? The answer is, this is known as an asmachta, which is a sort of hint which the Rabbanan find in the Torah for something which they decree themselves. But it's not actually the source for the law, because it's only Midrabanan. Be it as it may, the Mishnah tells us that Klal Mubar Maisers, the Chachom set a rule with regards to the tithes. What exactly is obligated in the tithes? So there are three conditions. Number one, Kol Shehu Oichel. It has to be food, human food, something which is eaten regularly by human beings. Secondly, V'nishmar. It has to be guarded, meaning it has to have an owner. So if it's Hefker, if it's ownerless, then it will be exempt from Maisers. And thirdly, the gedul of min ha'aretz, it has to grow from the ground and gain nourishment from the ground. So food like mushrooms, which gain nourishment from the air, not the ground, those would be exempt from maaseres. But things which have these three conditions, that it's food, that it's owned by somebody, and then it gains nourishment from the ground, chayv b'maaseres, would be obligated in the tithes. And the asmachta, the hint in the Torah for these three conditions, is that the Torah says, aser ta'aser es kol tevuas zarecha. You should tithe all the produce of your seed. So the fact that it's called produce shows that it has to be food. The fact that it's the produce of your seed shows that it has to be something which grows from the ground. And the fact that it says your seeds are echa shows that it has to be owned by somebody. And therefore, if it's ownerless, it will be exempt from maestros. So that's rule number one. Rule number two, the oikal ache omru, the Chachom said another rule with regards to what is considered obligated in maestros, or more, to be more precise, at what stage does something become obligated in maestros? So the answer is, kol shetchilase oichel v'seifa oichel, anything which is considered food, both at the beginning of its growth and at the end of its growth. For example, vegetables. Even when vegetables have only grown a little bit, they're considered edible. Afal pishu shomel ha'isif oichel, even if he keeps it in the ground so that it grows more food and it grows larger, Chayiv Kotman V'Gadol, he's obligated to tithe it, whether he uproots it when it's small or when it's big. Since at any point that he uproots it, it's considered edible, it will be obligated in tithes at whatever point that he uproots it. However, V'chol she'ein techilase oichel v'seifa oichel, any food which is not considered edible food at the beginning of its growth, only at the end of its growth, once it's grown a lot more, it would only be obligated in tithes once it has reached that stage where it's considered edible. But if you uproot it before that stage, so it's not edible for humans to eat, then it will be exempt from tithes. One source for this is that the Torah calls the produce which is obligated in maestros a fruit, which implies that it's a fully developed fruit and not something which is barely edible, and therefore if it is uprooted before the stage where it's considered edible for humans to eat, then it would be exempt from maestros. Now this second rule will really take us through many mishnayos of this mesechta, which will discuss the stage at which produce becomes obligated in maestros. Now food does not need to be totally ripe for it to be obligated in maestros. As long as it's edible and fit for consumption, it will be obligated in maestros, meaning the farmer will be obligated to separate maestros from that produce. So Mishnah Base begins and asks, "May emos ha'apeis chayovim b'maestros?" From when does different types of produce become obligated in maestros? And this stage is known as onas ha'maestros, the season or the stage at which produce becomes developed enough that it will be obligated in trumas and maestros. So the Mishnah begins its list: hata'enim, figs, mishiav chilu, from when they begin to ripen, which is when they begin to whiten as well. Ha'novim, grapes, v'ha'avoshim, which are a type of bad quality grape. Mishehiv ishu, which refers to the stage at which the outer skin of the grape can be seen through, so you can see the seeds of the grape from outside. Ha'oig v'hatusim, these are two different types of red berries, but at the first few stages of its growth, they are green. So the Mishnah says that Mishayadimu, from when they start to redden, and they are now considered to be red berries, that is when they are ripe enough to be edible and therefore obligated in maestros. And the Mishnah says that in fact, v'chol ha'dumim, and all plants whose fruit is red, but at the beginning of the growth it is green, Mishayadimu, as soon as they redden, that is when they are obligated in maestros, if they are uprooted then. Horimonium, pomegranates, mishia masu, from when they soften. And this means that as soon as one pomegranate seed, or the red part around the seed, can be crushed by one's hand, as soon as it's soft enough for that, then it becomes obligated in maestros. Hatamorim, dates, mishiotilu se'er, from once they've developed like dough which contains yeast. And that means that once the dates start to develop cracks, that is a sign that they are beginning to ripen. Ha'afarskim, peaches, mishiotilu gidim, once they have developed stringy parts, like sinews, on one's body. So that's a sign that they have ripened, at least enough that they are edible. And ha'egezim, walnuts, mishayasru mugura, which literally means once they develop a storehouse. And this refers to the stage where the actual nut in the walnut, the fleshy part of the nut, detaches itself from the shell. So it sort of sits in the shell as opposed to being attached to it. So in that sense, the shell is like a storehouse, and that it is holding the fleshy part of the gnat. And once that occurs, it's considered edible enough and fit for human consumption. But Rabbi Yehuda says, ha'gozim v'ashkedim, walnuts and almonds, only become obligated in mices at a later stage. And that is m'shiyasu klipa, once they develop a proper shell. And this is actually referring to the layer of the shell, which is on the inside of the shell and covers the fleshy part of the nut itself. And this only really occurs at the end of the ripening stage. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, that is when it becomes edible enough that it is obligated in Maisrus.